Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week, we salute one of America's greatest screenwriters, Dalton Trumbo, who is known as much for his Academy Award-winning scripts as he is being one of the infamous Hollywood 10 blacklisted Hollywood film industry professionals.
I suppose it's a trivialization of Johnny Got His Gun to call it an anti-war film, and yet I'm sure that's what the mass media are basically going to refer
well,
to.
Well, it's
that.
Easy to classify. You know, actually, it is a struggle of a boy to come back to life. Really is, you know, the struggle of discovery. The book and the film begin with the explosion. What is the first thing you would discover? I had to think of that. I thought about it for 3 or 4 years before. Well, the first thing I think you would discover, since you're covered with bandages, would be a hand touches you, but you don't hear the sound of a footstep. So maybe the hearing is the first thing you discover. You're deaf. Well, lots of things you don't want to hear. So you're deaf, so that's not too bad. And then the process of discovery goes farther and farther until it's bad.
Dalton Trumbo was born in Colorado Springs in 1905. He earned his first writing credit for the B-movie Road Gang in 1936. He quickly became one of the hottest and highest paid writers in Hollywood, lending his craft to all the major studios at the time: RKO, Paramount Pictures, Columbia, 20th Century Fox, and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. In 1939, the year Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind were the big hits, Trumbo published his award-winning anti-war novel, Johnny Got His Gun, which was told from the perspective of an injured soldier who would gradually learn that he was deprived of all his senses except his thoughts. Trumbo forced his publisher to remove the book from circulation when the United States entered World War II, but he would eventually make this into a film in 1971, starring Timothy Bottoms, Kathy Fields, Jason Robards, Donald Sutherland, and fellow blacklisted actress and friend of From the Vault, Marsha Hunt. When the House Un-American Activities Committee turned its attention to Hollywood, Dalton Trumbo and 9 of his colleagues' lives would change significantly beginning in 1947. Ironically, the Special Committee on Un-American Activities was formed in 1934 to investigate fascist and pro-Nazi organizations, including the Ku Klux Klan. Trumbo was actively anti-fascist his whole life. For 13 years, Dalton Trumbo would be blacklisted from working in Hollywood, which included being thrown out of the Screen Actors Guild. That meant that even if he wasn't blacklisted, he wouldn't be able to work in Hollywood. Trumbo packed up his family and moved to Mexico, where he continued to write for Hollywood secretly, passing his writing to fronts or writing under pseudonyms. Trumbo famously wrote in his bathtub with a parrot that Kirk Douglas had given him. Dalton Trumbo would win 2 Oscars during this period, one for Audrey Hepburn's first screen role, Roman Holiday, originally given to his front writer Ian McKellen Hunter, who we'll hear later on in the show from the memorial service, and one for The Brave One, which he wrote under the pseudonym Robert Rich. By 1960, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, was mostly discredited, and 2 brave Hollywood giants, Kirk Douglas and Otto Preminger, hired Dalton Trumbo to write 2 of the biggest films of the day, Spartacus and Exodus, respectively. There is a new biographical film out in 2015 about Dalton Trumbo, simply entitled Trumbo, starring Bryan Cranston, Diane Lane, Dame Helen Mirren, Louis C.K., and John Goodman, that reveals many of these facts. But let's go to the source, Dalton Trumbo himself, from 1971, and from people who knew him best, including fellow Hollywood 10 victim screenwriter Ring Lardner Jr., communist activist Dorothy Healy, and iconic actor Kirk Douglas. In 1971, Pacifica Radio's national correspondent Larry Binsky had the opportunity to interview Dalton Trumbo following the release of the film Johnny Got His Gun. This was originally broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley, California, now heard nationally, thanks to you and From the Vault.
You've been traveling all around the country. What has been the general audience reaction, if any, to the film so far?
Well, I haven't really seen the film since March 15th, because I'm so tired of it. I lived with it for about a year. The audience, I have watched them come out and they are somewhat stunned. It has not been for them, you know, really an entertaining evening. The critical reception has been about 5 in favor to 1 against. That 6th, however, is total and devastating. So, at least it is not bland.
I should explain to everybody listening that Johnny Got His Gun is a film which deals with a World War I soldier who winds up in a rather lamentable state. I haven't seen the film, but I read the book. In fact, I've read it twice during my long life of book reading, for one reason or another. It's a man who winds up being what you might almost call a vegetable in a ward, who is, as a result of his war wounds, loses everything except the concept and the conception of thinking about those wounds and where they came from and how they got to him. And I understand from friends of mine who've seen the film that this is graphically quite well translated. Did you have the... You wrote this book a long time ago, 1938. Did you for a long time want to make this film?
No. I never thought it possible to make. It never occurred to me to make it. I received one or two offers for someone to buy it, to make it into a film. Since I didn't know how to make it into a film, and since I am a screenwriter, I felt that they couldn't make it either. So I refused the offers, since I preferred to have what I think is a pretty good book than to have a bad film attached to it, at least a bad film made by someone else. In 1964, however, a Mexican producer named Gustavo Alatriste suggested to me that Luis Buñuel, who was an old friend of mine, would be willing to direct the film if I would write it, write the screenplay. I said, my God, I will do anything. I will come down, be his secretary as well. I will wipe his boots. I will carry his bags. I went down, and we had 2 marvelous weeks together talking about the film, and then I realized that by reversing it, you must get from outside, inside, the whole book is inside, must go outside in order to make it visual.
When you say the whole book is inside, I want to stress again that the book is a narrative, as I remember it, told by the consciousness, the only conscious factor remaining of this poor, devastated humanoid, of how he got that way, and the events that led up to it and his reflections upon the world and how it let him become a quadruple amputee and, in fact, a person deprived of all sensory response to the universe except thought. Quite a concept for a modern filmmaker.
Well, it's a very old-fashioned film. Incidentally, he really is not humanoid, because the humanity is in the mind, and his mind is clear. They think that he is decerebrated. Therefore, they regard his physical reactions as simply muscular, convulsive reactions, which have no relation to thought. They believe that the area of his brain, which has thought, memory, feeling, pain, pleasure, is destroyed. This is not as rare as you might think. In the last 2 years, I've gathered 8 instances, not from war, necessarily, some from automobile accidents, of people who have been pronounced decerebrated. Hmm. That is, that part of their brain which governs thought, recollection, pain, and pleasure is gone. The 8 instances, in each 8 instances, the doctor was wrong. And it was discovered that they could think, could feel. And that's what happens to this young man. But it's perfectly possible for it to happen. You know, doctors make as many mistakes as you and I, and sometimes more, and they're often more costly than ours.
Dalton Trumbo, have you, in your travels around the country and in your life, seen people who've been involved in the Vietnam War who might be in similar states to this person who was involved in the First World War?
Not in the same state. In the Second World War, I was a correspondent, and I saw a quadruple amputee as he was brought in to North General Hospital in Guam from Okinawa, where he had been blasted. He, however, had a wife and 2 children, and he did not have, therefore, a problem that... He was a professional soldier. His father had had both legs blown off in World War I. He was a sergeant. That's the heart of the army, the sergeant. Not the general, the sergeant, the pro. He had been a soldier for 11 years and was a sergeant. And he lost both legs and both arms, his hearing in one ear. He had shrapnel all over his side. But he had obviously considered the odds. He understood somehow. He had a wife, two children. They collected a large sum of money for him. He started a chicken ranch. He was equipped with mechanical appliances, and he made it. But yesterday, a young paraplegic, both legs, they're there, but they are useless. In his wheelchair, I was talking to him, and he asked me to sign the back of his chair.
What did you sign?
I said, I signed my name, which he wanted me to sign, and I said, in rage. Mm-hmm. And he felt the same thing. Mm-hmm. He'll never walk again. And he is comparatively lucky.
I suppose it's a trivialization of Johnny Got His Gun to call it an anti-war film, and yet I'm sure that's what the mass media are basically going to refer
well,
to.
Well, it's
that.
Easy to classify. You know, actually, it is a struggle of a boy to come back to life. Really is, the struggle of discovery. The book and the film begin with the explosion. Mm-hmm. And then he tries to fight. He discovers, this is gone, this is gone, this is gone. What is the first thing you would discover? I had to think of that. I thought about it for 3 or 4 years before. Well, the first thing I think you would discover, since you're covered with bandages, would be a hand touches you, but you don't hear the sound of a footstep. So maybe the hearing is the first thing you discover. You're deaf. Well, lots of things you don't want to hear. So you're deaf, so that's not too bad. And then the process of discovery goes farther and farther until it's bad.
And did you feel, in a cinematic sense, that technical advances and experiments made over the past few years aided you in exteriorizing this or in conceptualizing this mental state, or is the film, which I again reiterate I haven't seen, one that could have been made from the technical point of view a long time ago?
Could have been made a long time ago. You see, this is pre-World War I. This boy would have had to been born about 1897 to have been 2019 in 1915, 16, or 17. It's the sort of the adolescence of Western America, at least it was. And, of course, I was perhaps 6 or 7 years younger than he. So I relied on my own memories of the time, the place, the circumstance, the war. But the modern techniques didn't help because it's a very old-fashioned film. Most of it is in black and white, that is to say, his actual life in the hospital is always in black and white. That's the reality. And black and white is the color, really, of the 30s and of the 20s. There are no flight jump cuts. There are no wipes. There are no irises. There are no, every shot. We don't shoot through a girl's hair or through the back of a chair or through jail bars or... Every shot has to be plain, honest, simple, so that if one sees it, you know, the 80s are only nine years away. Isn't that odd? 1980. I wanted to make a sort of film that if one saw it in 1980 and knew nothing about its history, one couldn't tell whether it were made in the 30s or the 40s or the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. It has fade out, slow fades, dissolves. Nobody moves very fast. It has black and white. And I don't regard them as tricks, which are used in modern film. I regard them as very legitimate usages of film. But they're not for me, because they most of them occurred before 1925. Most of the things that are now very fashionable and very useful were used very early in screen, in cinema, mm-hmm. and are now being rediscovered. But this has to be old-fashioned, and it is. Nobody even moves very fast.
That's true in Berkeley, too.
Well, you know, it's true in jail, where when your time gets short, they say, walk slow, drink lots of water, breathe deep, and stay cool.
And hope that Governor Rockefeller doesn't decide to kill you.
Governor Rockefeller is capable of killing me or anybody else.
Mm-hmm. You didn't even consider updating the film then to give it more impact?
No. You see, how could I? I'm 65 years old. I know how young men talked in the second decade of this century. Had I updated to the Vietnamese War, the memories would have had to be different. He remembers his father, his mother. Well, today, as of 5 years ago, which would be his memories, the mother and father are quite different. This dialogue is different. His thoughts are different. He's a different sort of man. You know, in the first and second decades of this century, I think, was rather typical of a Western boy in a small town. We believed in hard work, success as a goal, marriage, ultimately, when you can afford it, which lasts for life. You went to church on Sunday. My parents' goals and mine, there was no difference in goals. Today, there is a difference in goals, and a total difference, which is why there is the gap. It didn't exist then. There was a naivete in this country. Imagine a boy in Grand Junction, Colorado, which was the town, I call it Jail City, in a town of 8,000 people where only two people in that town have ever been to Europe. You can go to Paris. You can go to London. We had high school assemblies. We cheered them. They volunteered as soon as they could, 17 and 18. They went to Canada to get in early. Marvelous. London, Rome. Save all of those French girls from being raped by the Huns. And those Belgian girls from getting their breasts cut off. And those Canadian soldiers from getting crucified in full view. This is what George Crail's propaganda machine had it. Crucified in view of their fellow Canadians by the Germans.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio host Larry Bensky in conversation with blacklisted screenwriter Dalton Trumbo from 1971 on From the Vault. We have a version of Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun adapted for radio in 1972 at WBAI in New York City. Not heard since, and we haven't presented it on From the Vault. If you would like a copy of that program or this program you're listening to now, please call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go to fromthevaultradio.org. And now back to the program.
Cece McGowan and I'm Larry Bensky, are talking to Dalton Trumbo, who is the writer and director of Johnny Got His Gun. Dalton, did you mean to say by that the mentality that you created in this young man is something that will be unfathomable or largely fictional to younger generations today?
I don't know. I had to do it. I had to do it correctly, because it is World War I. I find, for example, you see, there was an enormous amount of sexual reticence in let us say 1915 in this country.
I've heard about that.
I nonetheless think that certain things went on, but there was a reticence about it. And a shyness. Mm-hmm. I think actually there were more male and female virgins at the age of 17 than there are now. I think that was our loss and their gain today. But there was a whole difference. And it has to be understood. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the naivete of going into that war, which was madness.
You've survived one of the greatest calvaries and repressions that America can put on a person, short of actual imprisonment. I don't know if you were ever actually imprisoned.
Oh, yeah, only a year. But short of being black, let's say, or being Chicano, or being terribly poor.
For a white, creative, middle-class artist, you've survived one of the greatest calvaries that a man can have. In the McCarthy era, you were one of the Hollywood Ten, deprived of a chance to make his living, of a chance to express himself. Did you think in those days that something like the present climate would eventually come about? And are you surprised at the way things have evolved?
No, I'm delighted. Really not surprised. You know, things have a way of changing. And people change. The circumstances that exist in this country today, of course, would not have been imaginable to me. I consider, you know, them rather first-rate in many ways. For example, Attica. Take Attica. I was in Washington, D.C. on a talk show. On the night of Attica, when the report came through that they had slit the throats of 8 men. And I was there, and I found myself defending these men, these convicts, these fellow prisoners, in quite different circumstances than I had ever been. I found myself defending them. The next morning, I was so enraged, because they hadn't done it.
Yeah.
They had not had, apparently, it was not in them when the showdown came. The force and violence came from the other side, from the government. And although I'm glad I did defend them, I said, if you drive men mad, you may expect them to cut throats. But they didn't cut throats. They actually gave beds to the guards, and they slept on rock floors. Mm-hmm. They actually, according to Tom Wicker of the Times, who certainly cannot be called a prejudiced witness, they formed chains when certain of the more violent men, inmates, I don't like to call them inmates, men, wanted a little faster action. They surrounded these people with protection. And I, on a 2-hour talk show on the radio, had to defend them from against a crime. I had to assume it was done, and they said so. My God, all of the authorities of the state. The governor says so, Hulan says so, Oswald says so, God says so, the press, every newspaper in the country carried the story. You've got to believe it, haven't you? If you're going to believe anything. It was all a bloody lie.
There's one question I can't help asking you, Dalton Trumbo, that you're here as a person who was politically active in the 30s, and I won't ask you what party you belong to, but as a person who was definitely politically active in the 30s, what parallels do you see between the hopes and aspirations of those who thought they could change the world in the 30s and those who think they can change the world in the late 60s and 70s?
Well, they both are changed. They both change the world. Any kind of effort changes it in some degree. The parallels... Well, I could give you the year 1950. I looked through it. 1950 was the year that we went to jail. And I was looking through the World Almanac, a chronology of that year. What do you discover? You discover that was the year that Pablo Picasso was denied entrance into the United States. That was the year that Paul Robeson was denied permission to leave the United States, and Rockwell Kent. That was the year in which the Supreme Court, by turning down the case, affirmed the conviction of the 10 in which we went to jail. That was the year in which 157 professors, members of the faculty of the University of California, were fired because they didn't take an oath, a non-communist oath. That was the year in which the emergency detention bill, which was just repealed maybe last week, was put into effect with 8 concentration camps. That was the year in which the president's security program, which caught thousands of people, was installed. And it was pre-McCarthy. McCarthy hadn't begun. He reaped the harvest of this rich fruit of red hunting. You see, you could call anybody a red in those days. It wasn't really a red hunt. It was, I'm sorry to say that by and large, it was an effort on the part of the liberal community to cleanse itself. The opposition, which ultimately arose to McCarthy, and it was very feeble, was based on the fact, leave us alone, we can do it better. We can do it more cleanly. And they did. You know, they had, well, ADA started out. Now, ADA has changed. Well, so has everything changed. It began in 1947. And in the same year, there occurred an ugly little event in Berlin called the first meeting of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And the Committee for Cultural Freedom in this country was established. They published 13 magazines all over the world until about 1962 or 63. They traveled in great, great coveys like Quail. They traveled on jet planes, first class. They assembled in fine hotels in Beirut, in Paris, in Bombay. And they carried on the crusade of cultural freedom.
But wasn't that because they were a cultural elite that had no basic constituency except money?
It was because
them?
They were being paid by the CIA.
Yeah, right.
The CIA had sponsored the whole bloody mess. Every cultural congressman, and there were many. Let's take Fiedler, let's take Schlesinger, let's take Daniel Bell, let's take you name it, let's take Leo Rostin, let's take any of them. Mm-hmm. They moved from government to academia to the foundations. And as cultural congressmen, they lived on the fat of the land for 12 or 15 years, and they didn't know. They said they didn't. They were all astonished.
Are you looking forward to the review of Johnny Got His Gun in Commentary magazine?
Oh, yes, Commentary. And Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., who reviews for Vogue, which has a powerful influence upon the cinema. I don't think he's going to like it. If he does, I have made a mistake.
We've been talking to Dalton Trumbo. It's been a great pleasure to have you here, the writer and director of Johnny Got His Gun.
Dalton Trumbo died of cancer only a few years after this interview in 1976 at the age of 71. In the next segment, we go to the actual memorial service held for Dalton Trumbo in 1976. This is the only known copy of the service. We'll hear from Ring Lardner Jr., Ian McKellen Hunter, Kirk Douglas, and Dorothy Healy, a KPFK program producer and most likely responsible for recording and saving this tape for radio broadcast, now on From the Vault, and part of the historic record of the primary source documents of this American writer and filmmaker. The first voice you'll hear is host Ring Lardner Jr.
First of all, I'd like to welcome you all on behalf of Cleo and the family. At rare intervals, there appears among us a person whose virtues are so manifest to all, who has such a capacity for relating to every sort of human being, who so subordinates his own ego drives to the concerns of others, who lives his whole life in such harmony with the prevailing standards of the community that he is revered and loved by everyone with whom he comes in contact. Such a man, Dalton Trumbo was not. I have no figures, but as a close friend and observer for 40 years, I think it's quite possible he antagonized as many people as he attracted. I know that if he had ever conducted a campaign for public office, it would have been only a matter of time before he had alienated every separate special interest in the electorate. No one I've known can more aptly be described by the word fascinating, but a word of almost opposite meaning, abrasive, belongs in the description too. So do a good many other adjectives, including wise, funny, greedy, generous, vain, biting, solicitous, ruthless, tender-hearted, devious, contentious, altruistic, superbly rational, prophetic, short-sighted, and absolutely indefatigable. Very late one night, 30-odd years ago, he walked me to my car outside his house and with a broad gesture that encompassed every other householder on Beverly Drive, he said, "All those cozy bastards smugly sleeping away their 8 hours. They're living only 16 hours a day, and I'm living 20. So if I die when I'm 60 and they live into their 70s, I'll still be ahead of them." Well, he made it to 70 himself, against all reasonable expectation. But I think his figures were off anyway. He lived at least 3 normal lives, a sheer outpouring of energy so disproportionate to the intake of fuel as to transcend the laws of physics. It seems to me there are 2 general divisions of human temperament. One, comprising the vast majority and including many persons of superior talent and intelligence, embraces those who tend to accept the world as they find it, to go by the established rules and to yield to the authority of expert opinion, particularly in fields outside the range of their special interests. The other, much fewer in number, but large enough to contain its share of fools, scoundrels, geniuses, and mischief makers, are inherently, often arrogantly skeptical, dismissing the solid credentials of expertise and insisting on proving out each proposition by themselves, no matter how limited their apparent qualifications for the task. Trumbo belonged unequivocally to the second group. We collaborated on a screenplay once a long time ago, and our method of operation was for me to do a first draft, Dalton a second, and then for the two of us to go over it lightly together. Theoretically, a very sound approach. But the catch in real life was that when faced with the prospect of actually working, with the physical act of sitting down to a typewriter, he was the greatest procrastinator since Quintus Fabius Maximus, surnamed the Delayer, whose inaction saved the Roman Republic from Hannibal. It was an amazing phenomenon, the diversity of other interests that could win Trumbo's attention away from the clear-cut challenge of a blank piece of white paper. Producers who hired his imagination were likely to taste the first fruits of it in the form of ingenious catastrophes that were supposed to have afflicted the Trumbo household and kept the head of it from his typewriter. In the case of our collaboration, I had delivered my version, and there had been a long series of postponements of the hour when I was supposed to go and read his. But the last of these deadlines had been established with such an intense and fearsome oath that I arrived almost qualmless. And my spirits rose at the sight of a whole stack of non-virgin paper in front of him, which he pushed proudly to my attention. "I think I've got something big," was his simple preliminary to the revelation that he had been laboring day and night on improving not our script, but the common door latch. It seemed that some conventional installation at the ranch had failed him. Perhaps he had shut a door on Cleo sleeping and proceeded to some noise-making activity, not the typewriter, or at least not the typewriter on our project, and had found the latch didn't hold, and had decided his immediate mission in life was to redesign the way doors have been secured in modern times. And what he had produced was by no means a casual effort. Dozens of pages were filled with impressively detailed sketches and specifications for radically new knobs and internal hardware. He had not only solved a pressing problem, he assured me, the patent was going to make his fortune. No one is able to regard himself objectively, but in Dalton, the failing was more pronounced than in most of us. His published letters From the beginning of the blacklist in 1947 to the end of our prison terms in 1951 are full of projections of the new austere Trumbo that would emerge once our case and all contact with the movie business lay behind him. These deluded images are all the more striking because they appear in the same book with his brilliant and marvelously objective campaign to demolish the blacklist. Writing Johnny Got His Gun would make any life a notable one, though I think the novel he was writing at his death might have proved an even greater accomplishment. But it can be argued that that almost single-handed assault on the blacklist was the major achievement of Trumbo's career. It was such a serious matter for all of us involved that it was very hard to reach the insight that he did, that it was also an absurdity. From that insight came the corollary that the weapon to attack it with was ridicule, to make the absurdity apparent to everyone. And Trumbo, happily for the time and circumstance, had not only a splendid sense of the sublime, but a beautifully attuned sense of the ridiculous. Thank you. I would like to call on a number of friends who are here to say some words. First, Dorothy Healy.
All those adjectives which Ring used to describe Trumbo wouldn't be so accurate, and they are very accurate, if it wasn't that each of us who knew him saw those adjectives in a very different way, and some adjectives fitted more precisely to the individual with whom he was associated than other adjectives did. And I want to talk about Trumbo. Trumbo the revolutionary, Trumbo the man of politics, the man of passion about political action, because that was really the major aspect of our relationship. And I guess there's another reason I want to talk about Trumbo, the revolutionary. I guess just as when some well-known popular figure who has established a reputation as an atheist dies, there's always the mythology that develops that before death, the atheist had embraced religion as the guarantee against that great unknown. And all too often, human beings who have dedicated their lives to the fulfillment not simply of an individual talent, but to the fulfillment of others, in their death get robbed of the meaning of the life, particularly when that life has been a life that is identified as a revolutionary's. There's many memories that come of a Trumbo in the course of 40 years of political activity. I knew him during the many years that I was an organizer for the Communist Party here. And I guess among the memories that were important to me was the most difficult period, the period of the Smith Act indictments and arrests here, the trials, the period when many dear friends found it embarrassing and difficult and awkward to have too close a not only public association, but even a private association. And yet that was the point when Trumbo, coming out of prison himself, desperately in need of being able to reestablish himself, insisted on a very public role in a public defense of the Smith Act defendants, in the publishing, the writing of The Time of the Toad, in proclaiming his own identification, his partisanship with the defendants. Or an even more curious thing that tells you something about Trumbo. Trumbo had left the Communist Party, I think, I'm not sure the date when he left, but I do know that it was during those difficult years of the early 50s that Trumbo decided to rejoin the Communist Party. Not exactly a period in which there was an enormous outpouring of great support, but that stubborn strain in Trumbo that was as well the mark of the man's integrity was the most prominent thing then. His insistence, and I remember saying to him, but Dalton, everybody's, people are leaving at this point, and you're rejoining. Yeah, he says, that's why. Some of us got to stick around. And then when Trumbo left the Communist Party again, he refused to in any way identify himself with the professional anti-communists, with those who were not so professional, the amateurs, who found it in good stead to really degrade the very visions and the dreams and the hopes and the aspirations that had been so important. And then I saw Trumbo often in the 60s. That was an interesting period to watch. This very remarkable capacity to remain alive and aware and responsive to things that were totally outside of our own experiences of the movements and the ideas and certainly the rhetoric that had shaped and influenced us when we were young. And I remember long discussions I'd have with him. His very passion and his identification with those new movements, with the anti-war movement, with the Black Liberation Movement, with the Chicano Liberation Movement, and not simply in the reading about them in his studio, his library was always filled with the newest publications, but in his active contact with all these new movements. And I remember once saying to him, how do you stand the rhetoric, the silly rhetoric? And he pulled down off the shelves, you know, I remember his enormous capacity for keeping everything that had the printed word on it. And he pulled down a speech that had been made by one of our contemporaries and co-workers and colleagues. And he says, you've forgotten our language of the 30s. Really, he says, the respect for the use of language, we weren't, we had our own expressions that were as shocking to the ear as the current ones. But really, as I say, what was significant, he wasn't just a reader about these movements. There wasn't an anti-war demonstration elsewhere that took place here in the 60s. Not only did Dalton's name always appear as the sponsor, but Dalton's body was always present in those demonstrations. And I remember talking to him in the 70s, when I had left the Communist Party, and I wanted to explain it to him because we had been very close. And one of the things we talked about, I think I'd gone over, as is usual with me, to try to get some money for the New American Movement, and I was saying, well, but, you know, this is a new movement and no resources. And I think the one thing that really attracted Dalton and the thing that amazed me again about the man was his attitude toward the socialist world. Because this was the source of what seemed to be the greatest amount of cynicism and disillusionment and therefore the return to private life and internalization of everything on the part of many of our former associates. And Trumbo said something interesting about it. I think when I saw him, I'm not sure the date, he had just come back from Hungary. He was doing a film. And he said, you know, And he says, I'm the last one that would defend what happens as far as culture or the expression of the needs of a new kind of democracy that is commensurate with socialism. But he says, you know, I just never forget when everybody is wailing and sobbing and furious that they have solved the great problems that confront millions of people in every country of the world, of hunger and of medical care and of education and of jobs. And again, this interesting capacity for with all the sharp, incisive, and sometimes nasty wit, this looking always for what was present there that really did what I think was Trumbo's most important quality in all those years, the search to give expression to human aspiration, to help be a part of shaping and developing the yearnings and the dreams, to keep alive the awareness of the potentials that slumber within all humans. Above all, when I think of Trumbo, I also think of Cleo. And that was part of it, that you couldn't really think of Trumbo without thinking of Cleo. And we used to argue about that too, and Cleo and I would also have some debates as to, and this was before the modern women's liberation movement. And finally, I simply came to the conclusion after watching and seeing this combined approach toward all of humanity and Cleo's presence there and Cleo's activity and Cleo's role. Well, all the things that Ring had said, including the things of his capacity to alienate, half the time the end of the alienation took place because of Cleo. But above all, I think is what is really true, that there couldn't have been the Trumbo that is celebrated without Cleo. And now it's Cleo's fulfillment and Cleo's creativity that I hope we'll be celebrating. And in celebrating, we'll also, I guess the Schiller's comments in Don Carlos are as true as anything, to never denigrate the dreams and the visions of one youth. And that was Trumbo, who had the dreams and the vision as a youngster and who remained dedicated to that dream and to those visions.
There were only a handful of his fellows among screenwriters who became really close friends of Dulles. Unfortunately, the majority of them died before him, some of them quite prematurely. There were Paul Trivers, Earl Felton, Adrian Scott, and perhaps the closest friend over the longest period of time, Hugo Butler. But the three of those close friends who survived are all here today, and I would like to call on Mike Wilson.
About 6 months ago, I called Trumbo and asked what he was up to. He told me that he was writing his own eulogy. He said that he had become quite expert at this brand of rhetoric, having eulogized several others in the past few years. He said his estimate of himself was neither as awesome as that of his enemies, nor as awless as that of his friends. And he didn't trust some inarticulate and graceless son of a bitch like me to strike a proper balance. I suggested that he put it on tape so that his friends, later to be a captive audience, would have to listen to his raspy voice from beyond the grave. He thought this a fine idea. This is all in jest, of course. And if there are any here who find my mention of this conversation in poor taste, let me say that one cannot understand the man unless he appreciates his mordant sense of humor.
There have been a great many messages, telegrams, and letters pouring in since last Friday morning. And I'm going to read only one of them, and that only because of a special role that this friend played in what I have spoken of as perhaps Dalton's greatest achievement. It happens also that I introduced him to Dalton back in 1943. Today, I am joining you to bid farewell to Dalton. Knowing him, working with him, meant loving him. He was that rare human being who combined warmth and humor, sensitivity and wisdom, with a complete absence of sentimentality. Sometimes I did not see him for a long time, and when we met again, it was as though we had never been separated. I must stop now, or I will become hopelessly sentimental myself. Goodbye, Dalton. Otto Preminger. There is another friend here today who also played a significant part in that termination of the blacklist. I would like to hear from Kirk Douglas.
Obviously, I certainly wasn't prepared to say anything today, because I'm no fool. If I had, I would have gotten some bright writer to write some wonderful lines for me. And as I was sitting there, I thought what a fool I was. Many months ago when I was talking with Dalton, I should have gotten Dalton to do it. Dalton would have loved that. You'd have heard something wonderful, and you'd have heard something very funny. You see, when I first knew Dalton Trumbull, he was Sam Jackson. We were working, as a matter of fact, he was so many names, I used to ask him how could he keep up with all the different names he had. But at that time, it was Sam Jackson. And we started working together on Spartacus, and the telephone calls would come in, and some say, who's Sam Jackson? And the letters, Sam Jackson, those wonderful letters. Dalton's the kind of a man who could suddenly be enraged about something, and you receive a 40-page letter. Dalton, Jesus, put it in the script. 40 pages of a letter about something. It was a thrill to me to know Dalton, but I was very much ashamed when we were working, and I kept thinking, I felt so phony that here we were paying a man for his talents and he had to hide his name. And I'll never forget the day I said, Dalton, maybe I'm naive, but I'm going to put the name Dalton Trumbull. And Dalton laughed at me, said, you're stupid. What do you want to do that for? Sam Jackson's a good name. No, I had decided, I said, no, I feel funny about it. And at that time, when you look back now, it's almost kind of comical to think that, you know, it would be such an effort to have a man use his real name. My own name was changed by my own volition. But here he was using these different names and laughing about it. Well, working with Dalton is really quite an experience. Today, I got to say, it's quite an experience because I kept hearing a part about Dalton's life that I've known very little about, names that I've heard Dalton talk about often, his humor. Listen, We were working together on a project, and suddenly nothing was coming in from Dalton. I said, "Dalton, what is this?" And suddenly I heard, and I was furious with him. I said, "I have just found out, Dalton. You're supposed to be working for me and writing this, and you've been writing for Otto Preminger." He said, "Now, wait a minute, Kirk." He said, "Don't you remember when we were doing Spartacus and we screwed Otto? I was writing for you. Now it's your turn to get screwed." Well, Dalton's the only guy I know who could do it till you make you like it. Well, to me, the books, a few books in my library were some very warm dedications from Sam Jackson, and as he went into Dalton Trumbo, are very dear to me. My only regret is not seeing him as often as I would have liked. I admired, with all the compliments that people have paid Dalton today, I admired this professional attitude. I have never seen a writer who would, if you didn't like a scene, would just, in the wastepaper basket, was not fighting for his precious words. He would do a scene over many times. He had no great feeling that this was such a great scene. And yet, it's strange that with all the versions of scripts that I've worked on with Dalton, I did a little movie called Lonia the Brave. He worked on it, the script came in, and just the way the script came in, that's the way the movie was shot. Not one line was ever changed. So, I don't know Dalton's children very well. Of course, they were quite young, as mine were. But I know a lot more about Cleo than she'll ever realize. Because, and it used to fascinate me, the picture that Dalton would paint starting from the time when he was working in a bakery shop and the different episodes as we get talking that he would tell me about Cleo. And I must say, he painted a picture of a wonderful woman and someone that obviously he was very, very deeply in love with. So when I think of how lucky I've been, we've worked Spartacus, Lonely the Brave, I still have a project that I'm hoping to do that Dalton wrote called Montezuma, I really think that if I had never met Dalton, in a sense he would always be alive through the wonderful things that he's written. But I think once you know Dalton, then he's always alive in your heart. Thank you. And Cleo, I want you to say, I want to tell you that I loved your husband. He was a great guy.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. You've been listening to a program dedicated to the screenwriter Dalton Trumbo. We originally heard a 1971 interview conducted by Larry Bensky with Dalton Trumbo himself, and we just heard the memorial service featuring Reg Lerner Jr., Kirk Douglas, and Dorothy Healy. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part by loyal listeners and grants from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration, funding a project called American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, with help from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff, Sean, Mark, Joe, Jolene, and Edgar, and Mariana. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.